Hey guys, this is Lucas Sullivan. Don't worry, your regularly scheduled Radio Radar will still be coming on Friday, but we wanted to share an interview I did with Tim Schafer of Double Fine Productions, the man, the myth, the legend. So here you go. Hey guys, this is Lucas, and I'm with Tim Schafer from Double Fine. How's it going, Tim?
Good, good. Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. So you've worked on your fair share of games in your
Some
time.
Some games.
A couple
very
games.
Very old. I started in the 80s.
It feels like a different era. But today I want to ask you about lessons you've learned from games. What
nothing.
Happened?
Nothing
at all.
It's really hard. It's an important skill to acquire, which is the ability to learn nothing throughout years of experience.
You got to put effort into
it
that.
It keeps you young.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
Okay, maybe I picked up a few bad habits.
But I'm just going to go down a list of games you've worked on, and I just want to hear what you got out of them, personally, what
okay.
you took to other projects. So the first one, and if correct me if I'm wrong, but the first game you ever worked on was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the action game on NES. Is that correct?
Oh, my God. Well, kind of. You're really close. It was the PC version.
Okay.
I don't know. Did they make an NES version?
I think so.
The first things we ever worked on, like they hired us at LucasArts, a lot of us scumlets, they called us, people who were going to work in scum, and mm-hmm. also had no respect for people, the grunts. and they didn't have anything for us to work. They didn't have anything for us to work on right away, so they had us test. And so I did test Indiana Jones and Indy 3, mm-hmm. Based on the movie 3, the third movie. And it was the action game. They made an adventure game and an action game, which was really confusing to people.
And the action one didn't.
The action one wasn't an amazing game. I mean, it was probably could have benefited from a little more polish, as all games could have. But I just remember finding bugs. Like, I was right near the end, and I was like, hey, guys, I was doing that walk of faith, and I jumped off of the letters into the abyss, and the game crashed. And all the programmers just turned to me, and they're like, they wanted to kill me. So I think it's important for everyone who works on games to spend a little time in the test pit and know how it feels to, like, the kill the messenger mentality, you know?
Yeah, and I hear one of our writers used to be a bug tester. Sometimes you lay out a bug for the developers, and they just say, we're not going to – we don't care about that.
So I guess there was a lesson learned, which is be nice to testers. Don't get mad at them when they find – say thank you when they crash your game. Thank you, sir. May I have another bug?
Sweet. The next one I want to ask you about is The Secret of Monkey Island. Classic game.
Yeah.
Now, I imagine you learned a lot while working on that, but what was your biggest takeaway? Does anything still stick with you about working on that game?
Yeah, I mean, that was the first game I really, really worked on. I came to LucasArts, and then we messed around. We had this thing called ScumU, which is like Ron Gilbert coming and teaching us how to use Scum, the internal scripting language for their adventure games. And we had some old Sam & Max assets, not the ones they used in the game. They hadn't made that. They wouldn't make that for a few years. Mm. But C. Purcell was in the office, so he drew some Sams and some Maxes, and we played with them. And then Ron was like, I'm making this pirate game. You want to be on it? And so Dave and I joined his team, and we learned Scum and made our first adventure game there. And it was a lot of fun. And the thing I learned the most on that game, I think, was from Ron, which was to – not to censor yourself so much and not to be afraid of stupid ideas, because things would happen like we would write in dialogue. So we had to wire up a puzzle, so we just write in silly dialogue. And we kind of thought that it was not going to be used. We thought Ron would come in and write the real dialogue later. So we were just kind of that allowed us to take a bunch of risks that we normally probably would have censored ourselves from. So I thought, oh, they're not using this, so we're gonna put in a bunch. You know, Dave and I are putting a bunch of Star Wars jokes in there and a bunch of all this other. And Ron came and he's like, no, that's good. I'm gonna use that. That's good. We'll use that. And he was writing the ghost ship part. I was writing some Melee Island stuff, and Dave was doing some Monkey Island stuff, and Ron was doing the ghost ship stuff. And we switched around, but that was mostly how it laid out. And
So were you the one that came up with Stan?
Stan was the one character that, yeah. Dave was like the men of low moral fiber, and I was Stan, and he was Herman Toothrot, and I was the villagers. And that's another place where that censorship thing happened, where I was doing the I had to figure out a way to get the villagers to look the other way. And so he just put on the stupid dialogue line. It was like, look behind you, a three-headed monkey. And it was like, okay, obviously that's not going to be a real line in the game because there's no such thing as a three-headed monkey because that's illogical and that therefore it can't be in the game. And Ron was like, no, that's great. We'll keep that. And I was like, but no, that's so stupid. They can't have a three-headed monkey. And he's like, in fact, what we're going to have Steve Purcell draw a three-headed monkey. And the three-headed monkey is going to come out. And then Steve gets a hold of that, and he makes it, like, chew the banana with one mouth and swallow it with the other and all that funny stuff. And I saw that, and I was like, yeah, why was I afraid of that? Like, I can't believe I was ever afraid of putting something, because I just thought it was, oh, it's too much. It's too silly. And now, like, it's the process of, like, getting more and more experience with writing and making games. It's just learning to, like, not worry about something being too much. It's like, just let the freak flag fly.
Yeah, it's a good way of looking at it. Sounds like Ron Gilbert sort of fostered that,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
He taught me I'd be fearless and have nothing to lose.
So after that came Monkey Island 2: LeChuck's Revenge. How was it working on that game?
That was a much bigger game. Like it felt, and it was the first time we had real crunch mode, like bad crunch mode, where we're staying late till like 3 a.m. eating pizza and just going crazy and trying to kill each other. And what did I learn from that game? We're really ambitious. It was the first game that had iMuse and like this, the music system. Like you walk around Woodtick Island and the instruments change, and it was really fancy and. Then we dropped that because we felt like no one noticed. I learned about how much woodchucks can chuck. That was it.
how much can they?
14. I think that's been pretty well established. 14 pounds. So that was not the dialogue I wrote. I was trying to get that one cut. I was like, that is stupid. We got to cut that dialogue. That is not funny. But a lot of things that I tried to get cut ended up being people's favorite things, so who knows.
Yeah, that is funny. Like, do you still ever have doubts about something you wrote and then stick it in the game anyway? Because why not?
I mean, sometimes I like. I remember in Costume Quest, the guys had written this this line that was a reference to Arrested Development. You ever play Costume Quest?
Yeah.
You can go around and you meet this kid in a banana suit, and he's like, "Yeah, like the kid in the $50 banana suit's going to take advice from the kid in the $2 robot suit," or something like that.
Come on.
And I was like, "We don't. Okay, look, comedy is not just making references to other things. We're not going to make references like that." And it was Elliot Roberts or Dave Garner put that line in there, and depends who you ask. Dave says it was Dave, and Elliot says it was Elliot. But they left it in there because I realized, oh, I thought about all the Monkey Island Star Wars jokes that we made, and mm-hmm. how it was. So we left it in there, and then so many people, it was like their favorite line in the whole game because maybe because they loved Arrested Development or they just weren't expecting it there because it was changed enough because it was about a banana suit. But I'm glad I didn't cut that line.
Yeah, for sure. And I gotta ask, do you prefer Guybrush beard or no beard?
That's really interesting. I think I like the first two Guybrushes both equally well. I like both of those. I mean, I don't like his big hair that he later got.
The mane.
Yeah, he started to get this crazy out of control hair, and by the time they did the special edition, he just had this statue of hair on top of his head. It's just ridiculous. So both the Guybrushes, maybe the beard Guybrush. I might go for the beard Guybrush, but I don't know. There's something clean about that earlier Guybrush too.
It's very youthful. Very mm-hmm. very optimistic looking. Next, I'm going to ask you about Day of the Tentacle. Mm-hmm. And what I really want to know is, did you have to sign off on the tentacles appearing in Zombies Ate My Neighbors?
We know that was just being made in one building over, you know? Right?
Yeah.
No, we were just really happy they were using it. I mean, it was like a little community back then with all the LucasArts games, you know, and we were making Tentacle and Sam and Max was being made, and then they were making Zombies Ate My Neighbors. And they solicited, like, ideas for levels, and that was my one contribution was I submitted, I think it was Mars Needs Cheerleaders.
Oh, that's
that
awesome.
Level name, yeah, that was mine. Yeah. And then they took the Day of the Tentacle. I was just happy that we were in that game because I was like... that's a console game. It's probably going to sell a lot more than our little PC games at the time, you know. And so I'm glad we're in there. And that's one of the LucasArts games that people don't talk about as much, but I think it's really
Which
fun.
Which is a
game.
Shame.
Super creative, really funny. Yeah.
One of my all-time favorites.
I'm nostalgic about it because that SNES era was like a special, time. Special SNES time.
I have, you were just talking to Evan of PC Gamer in here. He's convinced that the Genesis version of Zombies music is better.
But
I'm telling him, Super Nintendo's...
Was the hardware different on the Genesis, the sound card?
Oh, God, yes. It sounds pretty awful, to be honest.
On the Genesis?
Yeah.
Really? Herzog's Vi sounded really great to me.
Maybe it's a matter of taste.
Who knows? You know, unheralded theme that I think is awesome on old sound cards is the Maniac Mansion theme. I think that's one of the great
one of the greatest songs of our time.
I think so.
So any particular lessons you learned from Day of the Tentacle?
Oh, lessons I learned in Day of the Tentacle. Sometimes I refer to that as the last fun game I ever worked on because it was the last time. It was the last time it was just easy, like because we hadn't started 3D yet and we had just started voice, but we added voice after the whole game was done. So it was our last simple development. Like we planned and executed on the plan, and it was exactly the amount of time we thought it was going to be. And it was this really fun. I had a co-project leader. Me and Dave were both leading that, And then after that, it was all just picking on these super ambitious games that were much bigger than the time. Like Full Throttle started that, and like, oh god, mm-hmm. And Grim was a little even bigger and scarier. And so, but Dot was just a nice thing. But what was an actual lesson I learned on that? Let me think about that. What else happened on that game? It was the first talkie.
Time
travel. It was the first full talkie of any game, too. Like, that's what we always claimed.
Yeah.
The first, like, every line of dialogue is read, and because it was on CD-ROM. It was, like, the birth of CD-ROM.
Because that was before Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And we learned... maybe I learned absolutely nothing. We learned... we invited George Lucas to come by the studio to see our games.
Oh, wow.
And he didn't really at the time. We felt like he didn't care about games that much. Like, he didn't personally play them. So he brought his daughter, Amanda, to... We took it as, like, hey, I'm going to bring someone who understands your language. She's a kid. And they came by our office, and we showed them, like... For the first time, we actually planned out all the rooms. Because on Monkey Island, Ron might have had a plan, but to us, it was mostly he would come in, okay, today... I told the artist, why don't you do a ship dock, and then you wire when that's done, you wire it up. And that's all the kind of vision we had of what was coming. And so, nowadays things are planned out, like, oh, you're going to have all these environments, of course, and it's much more reasonable. So on Day of the Tentacle, it's the first time we had done storyboards. Artists sketched out every environment on black and white, just pencil, and we put them all up, and we planned every environment, and we were so proud of ourselves for being that organized. Like, oh my god, we know every single room in the game in advance? What? And we brought George in, and we showed him that, and he's like, yep, can't make a movie without a script. And I guess that's what I learned. You can't make a movie without a script. Except for this is a game. But, still, it's important to plan.
Maybe that could be your epitaph, perhaps. You can't make a movie without a
script.
Wait,
is that you mean on my tombstone?
Yeah.
Can't make a movie without a script. That would be that.
Just a lesson to for generations.
All that's
to come.
Left. Okay. I guess.
Now, forgive me for asking, but you mentioned wiring. Is that just the process of branching out or planning out all the dialogue? Or
did I say wiring? Like wiring up the art?
Yeah.
So an artist would paint, like Steve would paint the inside of the scum bar. Mm-hmm. And then we take it, we'd wire it up, meaning like just like as if you're putting a pinball table together. We just like make everything move and work. Mm-hmm. So in the old days, we brought into our tools, which were all like scum, named after gross bodily fluids. So there was like phlegm was the level editor kind of. So we'd bring in that work piece of art and we'd draw on the floor every place the character could walk. And we'd say what scale they were at each place so they could get smaller as you walked in the room. And then we'd highlight every object that could move, and we'd highlight, get the art for the change state, and then we'd make all the torches go through their random three-frame animation, and that's what I was doing. And we used to do that all me and Dave in the beginning and Ron, and just wiring up all the rooms that way.
So how many man hours, I guess, of work went into each
room?
We were
just boys back then. It was boy hours. I feel like we'd get a room up in a day. There are about 100 rooms in the old event. I think there was a hard limit on the C64, so I think Maniac Mansion had like 100 rooms. Monkey had 100 rooms. Room is what we called it. Like the beach is a room, you know. Yeah. And I think we could get one of those working in a day. And then a dialogue, I remember, took 2 days to write usually. But we'd write them and implement them at the same time, which was how we learned to think about dialogue and as a process, like a flow.
Oh,
and
very cool.
The context sensitive. Like, okay, yeah. Are they carrying this object? Have they met this person? Should they ask about it? Do they know what gender they are? And like, figure that all out. And like, I can't figure that out with the game. Okay, I'll write it. I'll use different words that don't need, I don't need to use that. I'll use they instead of he, and it'll be fine.
How do you decide where to stop in a conversation? Like, okay, I've written enough jokes for
run
this.
Out of time. Run out of time.
Just cram as many jokes in there as you can.
You do. I mean, usually you have like a important data point. Like, these guys have to give you this object. Okay, I'm going to, I want that to happen after a certain number of lines. So I'll put that like 3 levels down. Then if it's going to be 3 levels deep, it should probably be about this wide. And so I'll put these options in there. And then I thought of a funny joke while I was writing that. So I'll make that extended and, you know.
I feel like you probably, it must be a lot of fun to come up with the goofy, like the answers no one's supposed to give.
Yeah, I think that's one of the fun things about dialogue trees is that you can tell 4 jokes at once without, and you know no one's going to pick these other ones. And I think Dave was really the master of those. Like, he put in lines that you wouldn't ever pick, but you'd laugh at them anyway, or you'd pick them and the character would say something else. And
yeah, like the Guybrush, the
That was one thing I wrote was his love. I wrote all the love scenes in Monkey Island, so because I was obviously the most romantic character in the team.
You had fire, passion in your heart.
Yeah, and it was always challenging to, like, okay, Elaine and Guybrush really haven't had much. They haven't been like on screen together much or had any chemistry, but now they had to fall in love in like 3 lines of dialogue. And those are interesting challenges that really make you, you know, think about the trimming down the fat of your prose style. So it's, you can execute these big emotional changes in 3 lines of dialogue. And so, and that's probably why the first time they talk, all Guybrush can say is, it's much easier to write.
It makes sense. Makes sense. So after Day of the Tentacle, there was Full Throttle, which is pretty big deal. Here's a question. How'd you come up with the name Adrian Ripberger?
Adrian Ripberger. Adrian might be... What's the name of the kid in The Omen? Damien. That's Damien.
Yes.
There was some movie where there was a demon child and he was named Adrian.
Children of the Corn, perhaps.
Was it? That's Malachi. Malachi? Malachi! I feel like there's some demon child named Adrian that I was imitating. Oh, no. But Ripberger was the name of my brother's girlfriend. Not her first name. Her first name wasn't Ripberger.
He called her Rip for sure.
Her last name was Ripberger. We just always loved that name. You're like, seriously? Your name is Ripberger? Seriously? So, yep. Ripberger. I got to look that up. Adrian. What is Adrian?
Maybe the good son.
What's that?
How do you spell Ripberger last
name? R-I-P Burger.
Just Ripberger.
Burger. Yeah.
And what lessons did you take away from Full Throttle?
What did we learn? I mean, that was, you know, that was a game where we really went deep on the presentation. Like, we really wanted it to be really cool, like a movie, and then we had to end up cutting a third of it just to fit the late schedule that we had, and that was really hard. And people complained about it being too easy because it was over. Like, a lot of those old adventure games, they were, for one thing, they had these insane puzzles no one could figure out, like use monkey on valve to use a monkey wrench, right? And Full Throttle didn't really have many of those, and it was more cinematic, and it went by really fast, and people complained about it, but it sold better than any other game we'd ever made at that time. Like, it sold like 1 million compared to I think Day of the Tentacle, I don't think it broke. Anyway, it sold a lot more than any adventure game we'd ever made. And it might have had to do more with the bicycles than with the things. And people might say that's why I made Broken Age a little easier, but it's more just, you know, watching people play them and seeing where they have fun and trying to capture the right amount of people who would have the most fun. And there's no right answer to it. You can't tune a game to everybody, but Full Throttle was definitely the game where I saw that people love to finish games, because we didn't. A lot of people did not never finished adventure games. And, you know, they'd be like, they start them,
just give up on the story halfway through.
Yeah, because you hit that bug, you can't solve it. There's no internet. That's, you know, if you didn't have the hint book, you'd just be like, you'd ask your friends,
call the hotline, maybe
have your dad sit down and figure it out. But like, you're stuck. But people like finishing them. That's why we put an easy mode in Monkey Island 2. Which Ron Gilbert called reviewer mode.
Oof.
Not me. That wasn't me. I really just...
You distance yourself.
Well, so he's respecting the time that it takes to review a game. And, like, can you imagine, like, having to play through a game and with no help at all?
I haven't had any walls I've hit, but I think when Dark Souls came out...
You're professional.
A lot of reviewers were hurting. to figure out how to progress.
I also learned the importance of awesome soundtrack. That was the first time we licensed music. We licensed this band, The Gone Jackals, because the guy drove up to deliver his demo tape on a motorcycle. So this is the guy.
Yep.
and that music was so perfect for the game. Like, there's no, you know. And then the importance of great voice acting. Like, all the other, you know, we said, this guy's a biker. I think about this to this day, because I see this a lot, where, like, oh, this guy's a tough guy. So everybody comes in, like, oh, I'm going to read the voice like this, and I'm going to be, hey, get off that bike. And they, like, you just feel you can tell when someone's trying to sound tough.
Yeah.
And Roy Conrad, who came in and did Ben, kind of understated it, and he was kind of like, whenever I smell asphalt, I think of Maureen. And it wasn't like he was trying to sound tough. It was just he was cool because he was so low and deep. And just having someone who nails it like that, just really look for that natural quality and actors who don't come off as trying to be someone they're not, you know, but mm-hmm. they just fit that role perfectly.
What was it like in terms of voice acting, working with Mark Hamill on that game?
Oh, that was so fun. He was just he's kooky. He's a really funny guy. Like, it was so far a lot. He was really interested in the OJ trial, which was going on. He had to leave the session to go, like, I got to go to the OJ trial.
That's
he was
bizarre.
Going to every day to watch it live. He was really into it.
That's and, so weird.
He played three characters in that game. He was Emmett and Todd and and Ripburger.
Okay, I thought he was only Ripburger.
Yeah, he's three different characters. Like Emmett the trucker, who has the rebel tattoo on his arm. And was it the Imperial? I think he has a rebel tattoo on his arm. See, Star Wars jokes constantly. we were just soaking in Star Wars all day long at LucasArts. We had mm-hmm. to get out of our system somehow.
Do you ever miss not being
what?
Not being able to work in the occasional Star Wars or Indiana Jones joke?
Well, nope.
Enough said. You mentioned earlier about playtesting and seeing where people get stuck in puzzles. How does that work? Like, do you literally just say, hey, sit down, play mm-hmm. this until you beat it?
We bring in someone who has no exposure to the game, and we just sit behind them, or ideally be behind glass or whatever, but we sit behind them and they try and forget that we're there. We don't say anything to them. We just watch them suffer and laugh and laugh and laugh, and then they leave and we make fun of them. But they, but you... You really do watch, and you can see things in adventure games, like where the cursor is going. And you're like, wait, why aren't they clicking on that object? They're supposed to, oh, God, they don't even see it. They just go, oh, they left the room. They didn't pick it up. Oh, come on. and sometimes I feel like there's good stuck and there's bad stuck in adventure games. And good stuck is where you're like, okay, I should be able to figure this out, but I'm just not getting it. What is it? There's something. I know it has something to do with that thing. Maybe if I walk over here, and that's good stuck. And bad stuck is like, fuck. Oh, sorry.
Go for it.
And like, where they're just like, I've gone everywhere. I've used everything. I'm so mad at this stupid game, and I know that I'm supposed to put this thing on there, but when I drag it on there, nothing happens. And that's, you know, they get to a certain point where they're really getting. It's not so much that they're stuck, it's that they're leaving the fantasy world of the game. Hmm. And they're now thinking about the game in terms of a meta. What did this game designer intend? And what, you know, maybe there's a bug here, and I'm going to stop playing. And I hate Tim Schafer. Like, when they get to that point, then you've kind of lost them, and you don't want them to get that stuck. So you kind of want, ideally, the game to have the hints built in where if they pound at it enough, and they go around and talk to everybody again, the game will start to recognize they're stuck. They've been through this room 8 times, you know, and they've asked this guy a whole bunch of times what to do. Maybe he needs just one more hint.
Just a nudge in the right direction.
Yeah.
The kind of stuck I hate getting in adventure games personally is when I feel like I know the solution to the puzzle that comes after the puzzle that I'm on. How do you avoid making that happen.
What does that mean exactly? Like,
so it's like, oh, I need to give this item to that person, and to get this item, I'll have to do something that I can't figure out right now.
Gosh, I mean, I feel sometimes that's good design in that you often like you present like an incomplete puzzle chain to somebody, and then there's a missing step, and they go, oh, they found the object that makes the missing step, and sometimes it's fun to. They plug that piece in, and the machine starts to work, and they get a reward. They get something new, but like, something still doesn't work. And because sometimes if it just works right away, people get disappointed. You know, you found people want things to be a little harder sometimes. So you want to kind of like make things not as obvious as they. You're like, oh, there's a door. Oh, and there's like if you walked in a room and there's a door and it's locked, and there's a key laying in the ground. If you pick up the key and put it in the door and open it, and that works, you'd be mad. You'd be like, that's stupid.
What a waste of time.
Or if you walk through a room and there's just a key in the room by itself and you pick it up and you're like, oh, I wonder what that's for. And then you walk in the next room and there's a locked door and the key works. You'd be mad too because you're like, what? But it's like you see the locked door and you can't – there's no key around it and you can't – and then you explore all around and then way up in the corner of one room you see a key hanging up but you can't get up that high. And you see that there's a ladder to get up there. And when you step on the ladder, the rungs break. Then all of a sudden you're in this active puzzle solving mode where you're like, okay, I know what I have to do kind of, but I don't know how to do it. Let's see what I can do with this ladder. Oh, I can find some wood over here. Now I got the pogo sticks, and I've got a grappling hook, and, you know, I made a grappling hook out of baling wire, and I'm off to the races.
So it's almost like that's a more open kind of environment for thinking about puzzles.
Yeah. Did I say that? Yeah.
Now, one question I have about Full Throttle is, did you ever lay eyes on the proposed sequels that they had in the works?
Let's see. I mean, I saw some concept art for the one. There was an earlier one that Larry and Jonathan, I believe, were going to make. The guys who did and ended up doing Monkey 3. And that had some I like Bill Tiller did some concept art. It looked pretty. And then I left, and then they were making another one when I was gone, and I saw some, and I did not like the 3D. It was like all 3D. And the first Throttle was kind of cutting edge for us in that we used 3D for the first time, but we painted over all of it. Like all the trucks and the motorcycles and the vehicles were all 3D, so we had moving camera, but then we'd go and paint over it because we didn't think we had the rendering skill to make stuff look good. And then Full Throttle 2, they're like, yeah, we can render it. It looks good. Look at that character. I was like, oh, God, that is ugly. That is really ugly. And it just – mostly when you make up a character, you just – and you see someone else's interpretation of that guy, it's rare you're going to like it. Because I was just like, that's not Ben. Ben wouldn't ride his bike that way. What is that weird crouch he's got
posture,
going on?
Yeah.
You know, it just felt weird and wrong. And, I mean, no version of Throttle that I wasn't working on whatever felt good to me. So, of course, it's not really fair to those guys that I just sabotaged that game behind his back and got it canceled. But – and I did that only by thinking really hard. I didn't actually get it canceled.
Pure force of will.
Every night before I go to bed, just think really hard about how much I want that game to get canceled.
Wishing upon a star.
Sorry, everybody.
And it seems like this kind of, after Full Throttle, that was sort of the end of an era. Do you ever miss pixel art in your games?
Yeah, I mean, pixel art makes me happy when I look at it. Like, it just, I think if a lot of us, the reason we like chiptune music and stuff is because we like, it pokes that part in our brain that was really, really happy and had when games had a sense of real wonder to us and magic. And I think it just makes us feel that way again. So I guess I'm just saying it's nostalgia, but also it is a cool graphic look. Like that really simple, that blocky look has an actual appeal beyond nostalgia. But I've never really thought about doing it just because I think other people have kind of nailed it and owned it. You know, I think Sword and Sorcery, you know, looking at that game and the pixel art in there and or some parts of Fez or, you know, other games I've used 8-bit graphics and I feel like that crowd has really done it justice and I think they got it under control, so that's why I've never... No need to butt in there because I think they're doing a really good job and who knows if I could do it that well.
So let's move on to Grim Fandango.
I learned a lot on that game.
I imagine so. I mean, you can go multiple lessons learned.
Don't use 3D. Don't use tank controls. It's an interesting perspective now because people complain about the tank controls in that game, but at the time, I mean, a lot of the inspiration for Grimm being made the way it was a game called Bioforge, which was a game by Ken Demarest, or you it's from Origin, I believe, and you drive a character in 3D through a world full of pre-render backgrounds, and I thought it was good because it didn't have that, the whole world didn't look all chunky in 3D the way the 3D games looked back then. It was like a early VR was all really just really simple,
pointy,
everything was really pointy, and I didn't want it to look like that. Bioforge didn't look that way. And I also had these controls, and because they're tank controls, you'd press forward, like move forward, and the character would just move forward, but they'd move through all these different camera angles. Like, he walked down this hallway and there'd be a low shot of him that looked all cinematic, and a top down shot and a sideways shot, but you didn't get disoriented because you're just pressing forward relative to the character. So I had to argue for these tank controls. I was like, this is the way, this is going to make the character feel like you because you're centered in the relative to you. And Resident Evil is doing this. Mm-hmm. Tomb Raider is doing this. This is cool. Looking back, it's probably not the right thing to do. And but we did put in what we called Mario style controls. We had either Tomb Raider or Mario style, because like Mario 64 had just come out, and the idea of having screen relative joystick controls was just revolutionary. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to point left and the character goes left, and I'm going to point towards the screen even though the camera's moving, you know, because you have to recalculate. We can't do that. We'd have to recalculate every frame where the camera is. And that was just such a great advance of the best, like, 3D character. Like, the first time that running a character around in a 3D world felt really great was, to me, Mario 64. And so we put that mode in, and you can play it that way. So people really shouldn't complain. They should just enjoy the Mario version of that.
I honestly had no idea that there was a Mario
but
mode.
But the thing that I wish we had done is put in some sort of point-and-click way of dealing, because there really wasn't any reason. I was so excited to be moving into a character-based game controls, because I'd played Mario 64 and Final Fantasy 7 and I really liked how those controls worked, and there's no reason why adventure games couldn't have that. But I see now that there's something special about pointing and clicking too. I mean, it does create a distance between you and the character because you're not driving the character around, mm-hmm. but there's an advantage to it too, which is that you can point and you can click.
Two simple things, mm-hmm. coming together. How about the scene in the game where you Manny reaps the first soul that you mm-hmm. you see, was that supposed to be as nightmare-inducing as it was?
Yeah, where did that idea come from? I'm guessing Peter Chan. Peter Chan likes to collage things together. And, I'm trying to think if we actually had a certain reference in mind, but we really wanted the world of the living to be kind of horrific and surreal. To mm-hmm. the people in Land of the Dead.
you succeeded.
We didn't do it too much with that game. The music also gets really creepy.
Yeah.
It gets all bent and
it's
twisted.
It's like 1950s, but played backwards.
Yeah.
And what's your favorite year of Grim Fandango?
Year? The 2 is really the most expansive one. Mm-hmm. The Rubikava is really the one that... We didn't have to teach you anything. We didn't have to explain the story. You know, we could just go nuts with puzzles. And each year was that big at first, but as always happens, you find out you just designed your game too big, and so we had to cut. Year 3 got cut a lot back, and year 4 got cut a lot. And there was a big, like, rooftop casino chase with year 4. There was a little bit of rooftop stuff in there, but it was much bigger. And so they used to have all equal number of puzzles. It was very mathematically formulated because Full Throttle was considered too short, right? And I was like, okay, I counted, and there's 20 puzzles in Throttle, so I'm going to have 40 puzzles in Grim. And so they all had – did they all have well, – that would mean 40 is 20. That would mean 10 puzzles a section a year. So that would probably was more like 80 puzzles in Grim. 80 puzzles in Grim.
Good God.
40 and 20 per year. So then the cutting happened. And so year 2 ended up the most intact because we'd already gotten that one done.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, see, that's how things work. And and also just had all these crazy characters like Olivia, Afrenda, and Hector. Hector Lamont. Hector Lamont isn't there. I mean Maximo.
Maximo?
Who's
Maximo?
He's played that game a long time. He's a casino owner.
Oh, okay.
And Gladys gets drunk. Which is always funny. And the giant cats.
Yeah.
And Peter just did these amazing, like when he put a ziggurat on top of a ship, a cruise liner, that was just crazy. It just looked so cool. And I just loved that part of the game.
Yeah, who came up with the cat races? That was such a out there thing.
I feel like it was part of the art brainstorming. Like, we were looking at the reference, and one of our reference books had these, like, papier-mâché cats that were all painted bright colors, and wanting to have them, like, pull. They were going to pull this boat across. You were going to sail a boat back to... let's not talk about the stuff that got cut.
Too sad. I don't want to upset you.
And we didn't even show the cat races, but in the original game, you'd see these cats racing around. It was going to be awesome. But now you only get to see Sam's booth.
I see it in my mind right now, mm-hmm. So that's enough. And in terms of... So you said you have a count of puzzles. Do you still use that practice today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was doing that with Broken Age. I don't remember what the final count was, but I would break it down by different sections and with each act. I feel like each side of each act was like 13 puzzles, so it'd be like 26 puzzles, and then we added a bunch and then split it in half. So I was still counting them there. I mean, because you get lost in your design, and you look up and you're like, whoa, 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 I've designed this way too big. Or the opposite is like, okay, that's dumb, but it feels really light to me. And you really have to count sometimes, just count the puzzles.
Has it ever gotten to the point where maybe it's crunch mode and you've worked yourself so hard that you can't remember the solution to your own puzzle?
Not while we're making them, but years later, like, I played the Monkey Island Special Editions, and I had to look up hints on that game, which amazed me. And sometimes those puzzles,
that's wild.
I am 46 years old, super old, and I mean, I couldn't. Almost the only one I did remember was the monkey wrench, just because it was so horrible. But I got stuck a couple times, and I haven't played Grimm in a while, so I don't know if I would get stuck.
But I'm really upset that you can't really resist. You can't buy
it.
And on Windows 7 and 8, it's just, like, impossible.
Have you used Residual?
I've tried the virtual PC, like, Windows 95 mode. Couldn't get it to work.
There's a thing called residualvm.org website, which specifically is meant to run Grimm, if you have a copy of Grimm.
Oh, wow.
It's not a copy of Grimm itself, but it's like ScumVM.
This sounds like something I need to download.
ScumVM, it helps you run old Scum games, and residualvm.org helps you run Grimm, and they fixed this bug in it, which drives me crazy. I found out like 15 years later that most people didn't hear Domino's second dialogue. Like, on year three, Domino lays out the plan of the number 9 tickets and Hector Lamont and what they were all up to. And if you had talked to him in year one, he wouldn't give you the speech in year three because it checked the same variable that it checked for the first. It was so stupid. And no one ever caught that bug. And most people who play Grim Fandango probably never heard Domino explain. Because a lot of people are like, there's a lot of plot holes in that game. No one, what were they doing with those tickets and the number 9 and all that stuff? And I was like, we explained it in the game. And I found out, no, we hadn't.
Oh, God.
So I think if you play the version on Residual, I think he fixes that bug. So
that's a cool touch. That's very cool. And after that came Psychonauts, which you did with Majesco, I believe.
Majesco picked it up after Microsoft dropped it halfway through.
Those jerks. Those jerks.
Yeah, Majesco. It came very close to putting us out of business. We pitched that game to every single publisher in the world. And worlds, and every single publisher passed on Psychonauts for sure.
What was their reasoning?
Like, I pitched it. I won't name the publisher, but one of them that I remember, we went in, we pitched the game, and the demos always went well. People would laugh, and they would say, "This is great." And there was one publisher from a big international publisher said, "Oh, that's great. This game is really, really creative. It's just so too bad that people aren't going for creative stuff anymore." And I was like, "What are you talking? You can change that. You could go for this right here. Sign this game.
You have the power to."
And that's what I learned that about the C word. That creative. You never want to hear if you pitch a game to somebody, and if you hear the word creative, you're dead. They're not going to sign it. You want them to hear the M word, which is money, not the C word.
Not rated M for mature. Yeah, that's. That's a rough lesson to learn.
So that's what I learned. Never make them feel like, never. Don't hide the creative. And I actually seriously would do that when I pitch games. I would emphasize the parts that sounded like money and turn down the parts that sounded like creative, because you really are doing the creative thing somewhat for yourself. Like, you're doing, like, I want to make a really creative game because that's what I enjoy doing, and that is for my own pleasure and the people I think playing the game. But it's not going to, you know, I mean, it does help a publisher think they want to know how your game is going to stand out. And, mm-hmm. but they don't want to stand out too much. So you just downplay the creative and play up how it's like this other game that made a lot of money.
They don't want to make waves. It's too risky.
Yeah. Like I would pitch, if I was doing that again, I would pitch Psychonauts. Like, it's basically Harry Potter. There's a kid who joins an elite force of people with special powers who are in a training facility, and it's like Harry Potter 2, essentially.
The kids will love it. What's your favorite mindscape in Psychonauts?
Well, I feel like Black Velvetopia was just beautiful, and it was really special in that we struggled a lot in the beginning of that game. I mean, Microsoft wasn't crazy in canceling us. We took a long time figuring out how to make a console game. And the sad thing about being canceled is we had finally figured it out. And how we figured it out was we made the Black Velvetopia level.
Wow.
I think we got it. And Eric had this idea. Eric Robson had this idea for the bull running through and the doors that would open and shut. It was my idea to do Black Velvet just because someone gave me these Black Velvet paintings. And it just triggered this feeling that, like, I've never seen that in a game before. I've never seen Black Velvet in a game before. Let's do this. And then that was the first level in the game that was fun. Because we'd done other levels kind of halfway, and they weren't coming together. We just hadn't. So that was where we hit our stride. We're like, yes, this is the game. And then that's when they canceled it.
That's awful.
Should have been there. But so that level was pretty special to me. And also the milk. And I like them all. Hey, I wouldn't put them in there if I didn't like them.
Very true. Very true. How about Brutal Legend? I feel like that's a divisive game, in a terrible way.
Between cool people and jerks. liked it and jerks didn't, so I think it was pretty divisive in that way. Wait, so what did I learn at Psychonauts? Oh, don't pitch the creative part of it. Pitch the money.
Pitch the money.
Yep. Brutal Legend is a very important lesson in how to message your game properly so people know what they're expecting. A lot of this gets blamed on EA, our publisher, which is not really that fair because our first publisher, Vivendi, definitely said, we are not going to mention RTS ever. We're never going to say the three letters RTS. You can't use those letters.
Banned word.
And I was like, but there are these RTS parts of it, and what if the press asks me, is that an RTS game? And the guy was like, no, you'll say no. It's an RTS. They're so, like, everything
out
said
out
that
lie.
Action sells and RTS is played by only just a few freaks in Germany. He's like, and I was like, are you sure? Because the whole point of that game was inspired by Herzog's Vi on the Sega Genesis, speaking of Sega Genesis. I just loved
it. Oh, right on.
The first RTS game, it was on console. It wasn't cursor-based, and your avatar was the cursor, and you flew around and landed and stuff like that. By the time we were done, I really did feel like calling it RTS was a little different because you played it differently, and just saying that got me in trouble when people thought that I was telling them that they were enjoying the game wrong. But so they absolutely, the first publisher, didn't want to say it at all. EA didn't have a problem mentioning it, but they definitely wanted to emphasize the third person action part of it. But they made a whole press event about the multiplayer in the game. They brought all the press. People knew about the multiplayer part of it. It just wasn't as widely distributed, and it wasn't in the demo. And it was mostly not in the demo because the single-player campaign of the game was added later. To kind of tutorialize the multiplayer part of it. So each level taught you a different thing of it. So it started off with you having none of those controls, just learning combat acts, and then you got squad controls, and then you got to build squads, and then you got to have these different commands. And then, so our demo usually, like a lot of demos, is just the first level. So it just didn't have any of that progression in it. Mm-hmm. And we talked about ways to add battles to it, but we were now making this fake thing that wasn't in the game, and it just felt like a dog and pony show. So we didn't do it, and a lot of people fault us for not having that part in the demo. We should have just made another demo.
That's a really hard thing to show a chunk of, I feel.
And I still vouch for that game. I believe that it is fun, but we didn't message what it was well enough, and we didn't tutorialize it well enough in the game. So we teach you the functions. We mention each control. We tell you how to do individual orders. But we really don't teach you why to do any of those or how to play the game well. We don't teach you how to be successful in that game. And so people picked it up, and there's a crowd of people on Steam who play it in the PC version and get together. And multiplayer, I will still vouch for it, is super fun. I play it with fans like once a year on October 13th often.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it's really, I feel like didn't get, you know, I don't want to say it didn't get a fair shake, because then someone will extract that and it'll become a headline like Schaefer says, for Legend, I get a fair shake. It'll be a picture of me, like my face on a baby's body, and I'll be waving a rattle and crying because...
Keith.
So let me not say that. Let me just say it's a fun game. You should play it. And that's what I learned just about the tutorializing it and messaging it. I think it would have had a much. It would have gotten a much better day in the sun. Day in the day in hell. A much better day in hell.
Which of the factions is your favorite? Because it took me a long time to figure out that, like, oh, I can actually play as the enemies in the multiplayer.
See? We didn't tutorialize that one. My favorite faction was actually Cut.
I want to hear all
about
it.
It's hard to say. We showed a little bit in the art book, but there was a faction that was really the first faction that I wanted, which was a faction that was based on Hot Rod Demons. It was all based on, like, Big Daddy Roth type bug-eyed demons, like Glottis.
Yeah, with the
with shifters and tongues hanging out, and we made them. I mean, we have those characters that were driving around, and we always held on to those as, like, they're called the Motor Freaks, and we held on to that as, like, someday when we make a sequel or something, it's all going to be about these guys. And, Someday. See, now I was in an interview recently, and they often ask about sequels. Do you ever want to make a sequel? And the answer is always yes. Like, yeah, I'll do a sequel to that, but we don't have the money, or we're working on something else instead. And somehow that turned into a news item of, like, Tim wants to make this. So it's not like right now I'm trying to make this version of Brutal Legend. It's not a news item. It's not for right now, but someday.
It's a blessing and a curse
we'll
to have that. That
someday
kind
we
of
will do the playable Lion White faction, and we'll do the playable Motor Freak.
Very cool.
Someday.
And you're
with all our Broken Age money.
Scads and scads of profits.
Hopefully. Come Tuesday.
And are you kind of buddy-buddy with Jack Black now that he's done voices for two of your games?
It's so funny you should ask. I just saw Jack Black last night.
Well, do you have a nice...
It implies that we hang out all the time. I see Jack Black about twice a year. And he was Tenacious D played in San Francisco last night, and I got to see him. And we got to go backstage and hang out with his sweaty body.
It's the only way you want to hang out with Jack Black.
Exactly. He's a real gentleman and a very he's a really nice guy. He's a very friendly guy, and he really likes games. And so it's fun to work with someone who's really enthusiastic about making this game. And he's fun to hang out with, and he. Did so much to promote that game. Like, he did so many videos and all these crazy press things and wore that muscle suit everywhere. So he really gave us he worked really hard for that game.
And how about
and he's a great actor too, and it's so fun having him in Broken Age do a completely different character. So I knew he could do, you know, we kind of went after him because he was so like Eddie Riggs in my mind, but then wanting to see, because he has this other side to him, of see what he could do with Harmony. I mean, yeah, Harmony Lightbeard, the guru in Broken Age, soft spoken, gentle, fraudulent cult leader that he was. And he just nailed it. It's really funny. We added lines to the game because we liked his character.
That's awesome. How about Tim Curry, who was also in Brutal Legend?
Yeah. It's funny. People are always like, oh, when you work with famous people, you got to watch out. They're real prima donnas, and they're really... And Tim Curry shows up, and we were late. We got caught in L.A. traffic. We were late to the recording session, and he was so nice. He's like, oh, hey, how you doing? And I just think people sometimes think anyone who's creative is like a prima donna because they care about the... They're like, yeah, I don't want to do this, seem this way because I care. It's not that they're prima donna, but they just want to anyway. So he was great, and I got to bring my copy. Everyone else, like Rob Halford and Lemmy, I got to bring albums for them to sign and Ozzy. And I knew he had a song. Tim Curry had a song called I Do the Rock that was a small hit in the 70s. Have you heard that song?
No.
Look, I Do the Rock. It's a good song.
I found his
album on eBay, and I bought it, and I brought it down there. And he was like, oh, my God, I'll sign that. That's awesome. So I have his album.
If I ever meet Tim Curry, I will get him to sign a VHS copy of Muppet Treasure Island because I cherish that movie.
Congo, I feel, is his finest work.
Now, you mentioned this earlier, but how about Costume Quest, which you did a lot of writing for, correct?
Yeah, I did. I was floating around different projects at the time, and they needed some help with writing, and so I helped out with that. Don't cut the reference to Arrested Development, is what I learned on that game.
Joe Bluth is the way to go when it comes to dialogue.
I mean, there are definitely things that we learned on that game. I mean, that was the first game that's the first game I've ever been associated in my life that was not just finished on time, but finished early. Like, they got told, like, you guys, we got to pull this in a month if we're going to hit Halloween with enough lead time. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, my God. And it helped that we just totally decimated the stacking team, brought everyone over and finished it. But It was done on such a small budget and such a small amount of time, and it's such a charming game, and people play it every year, and they ask for a sequel all the time, and I'd love to go back there, but that's not a news item.
The DLC, I mean,
yeah, Grubbins. That was,
that's like a whole nother theme, basically.
Yeah, and that one I didn't do any writing on. Gabe Miller did all the writing by himself mostly, and it was really fun. It kind of touched almost on being a Christmas DLC, like it was, but it didn't dare. It didn't dare actually say Christmas. It's kind of like holiday,
snow, holiday, cold. Yeah.
But because we wanted to do other like Christmas quests and stuff like that too. But we the problem with other holidays is that there's rarely is there any trick or treating in them. Halloween is
it's a shame, really.
Yeah, I don't know why, but. I mean, there's caroling, but ugh.
You could do, like, Easter Bunny egg hunts, maybe. Get some candy.
You don't go door-to-door and ask for eggs.
It'd be weird. It'd definitely be weird.
Yeah, so that's what I learned. Don't go door-to-door and ask for eggs.
It's a good life lesson. What's your favorite costume in Costume Quest? I remember mine being the Gundam-style mech.
Yeah, but you get him so early, you see a lot of him. Mm-hmm. But by the time you get that unicorn, it's so hard to find the unicorn in the mall. And the unicorn's attack is just all magic. It's just beauty and magic, all just
100%.
Attack. It's the highlight of the game when that unicorn comes in with his rainbow effects. Whoosh! So I like the unicorn. In the DLC, I like the eyeball. the eyeball. And, yeah, I think I'm going to stick with Unicorn. I mean, there is the patriotic fervor of the Statue of Liberty also is a big crowd pleaser.
That was a good one. I remember the cat costume being a tricky one to get.
That's like, I think that's the last normal gameplay one that you can get.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And to kind of jump off of Costume Quest, what's it like doing the Amnesia Fortnite event?
It's awesome. I mean, we've always enjoyed it because it's a break from what we're doing. You know, it's a game jam in the company where we stop. Amnesia means we forget what we're working on, which the first one was Brutal Legend. Mm-hmm. Forget about Brutal Legend. Forget about heavy metal. We're going to work on totally different stuff for 2 weeks. And we're going to break into four groups, and we're going to make four games in 2 weeks. It's crazy. But that short amount of time just forces you to focus and not do too ambitious of a game design. And it came up with Costume Quest and Stacking and Iron Brigade and Once Upon a Monster and Middle Manager Justice and all these crazy games and Hack and Slash and Space Base and Autonomous. And so that's always been fun, but there's always been this troubling thing about trying to pick who lives and dies when, like, oh, everyone pitches me the games and I would do, let's do this one, not that one. But now we do it open to the public and they all vote, which is really interesting because they pick different things than I might have picked, but once they pick them, I kind of see. Like, I didn't know. I mean, I liked. I knew JP could run a project, and I knew that it sounded interesting, Space, but I didn't realize that there's a whole different community behind those types of games.
Yeah.
People who play Prison Architect and Dwarf Fortress, and who want to create their own moments of storytelling that are unique, and just want to be involved in a game that's broken or not finished, and early on, and help steer it into completion. Like, I it was a big education for me that came about because people voted for that game. And I was like, oh, I can kind of see why you like these kind of games. So it was the Amnesia Fortnite being public, it means it's no longer limited by my intelligence. It's now expanded into everyone's. But I still weigh in heavily and be like, I think this game is stupid.
Do you ever have the power to, like, if no one votes for the game you liked best, just be like, well, make it anyway?
Well, no, because that changes my mind. I'm like, no one voted for that? Huh, maybe that is stupid. But... it all kind of works out in the end, I feel like. It's not a fair process, but neither is the games industry.
So. Very true. And do you guys view that two-week period as, like, a vacation, kind of? Or is it, like, super crunch time?
It's both. It's a vacation for me, because, like, teacher's week, it's like all the students are gone and I can just write, because I don't work on the projects. Mm-hmm. But it's for the team always describes it as, like, they work all day and all night and on the weekends, and it's crazy. And we don't really have crunch mode at the company that much anymore, ever since, like, Psychonauts was so crunchy. Mm. And but they have crunch mode often during Image of Fortnite, and they describe it as like the happiest time of the year. Like it's, they just get so excited. And I don't know what. Maybe it's just the happiness of not working for me, or just something just makes them go nuts. But they just, like, I guess because they believe in the idea, and they see the deadline coming, and they know every moment counts. That they just put their heart and soul, and they know it'll be over soon, so they just give it all they got, you know. And they just, it's like a sprint.
Do you have people like sleeping under their desks, living at work,
yeah,
basically?
Yeah, but they're happy about it.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like an awesome slumber party, a 2-week
like,
slumber
let's
party.
Let's just do this every 2 weeks, you guys. But they're like,
that might be a little taxing.
Yeah. And then it's over, and this time, this last time we did it, we documented the whole thing. So there's a daily, the documentary crew, Two Player Productions, made an episode every single day, which is crazy, 20-minute episode. But and I enjoyed watching it, which is weird, because I'm in the office with these people, and I get sick of them, but still, here I am, watching a documentary about them.
Now, another game to come out of the Amnesia Fortnite was the Sesame Street Once Upon a Monster. Mm-hmm. What was it like working on a Kinect game? What did you take away from that?
What I took away from Once Upon a Monster was the idea to make Kinect Party, or Dopamine Hack the Action Theater, which was, I was watching that project go. I mean, I learned a couple of things. Like, it's hard to work with someone else's property. Mm. And the only reason we work, because I had said we never did licenses of the company. We're good at making up things from scratch. So let's not work with anybody. But, you know, that Sesame Street thing had a special thing. I was like, okay, Sesame Street, Cookie Monster is pretty awesome. And yes, we believed, we liked the mission of Sesame Street. I mean, it's a real, like, pro-kids mission. It's not a commercial thing where they're trying to, you know, get money out of kids. They're really trying to make kids' lives better and stuff. And it was great to be part of that. But it was hard to solve problems when we couldn't change the essential nature of the characters. Like, no, Cookie Monster doesn't do that. You know, and Grover, Elmo never says, uses pronouns. He always says his Elmo. You know, it's just hard to, like, okay, write down, okay, Elmo always says Elmo, okay. And Grover never uses contractions, right? He never says it's. Grover says, it is, I am. You know, like, there are all these things. And then you can learn these rules, and that's fine. But then they're just, you know, when you're making up your own world, I can be like, and let's have the spoon talk. Okay, the spoon talks. And, you know, there's things that don't make sense, but they make sense in your world because you're creating it. So it's just a lot easier. So I learned it was harder to work with other people's properties, even if they're great. And I also learned that Kinect is this amazing technology that can invite new people into the world who just hate controllers. They never touch a controller. But it doesn't work for kids under 5. Like, they end up of your gameplay experience, like, the games that existed at the time didn't really work. Because kids, you know, you stand still. If you want to play with this tiger, hold your hand into this ring and stand still while the ring times down. Trying to get a 2-year-old to do that, they're just like, what? And they're running around in circles. And it made me feel like, but this technology should be able to capture my kid. And, like, even though she's only 2.5, and what if there's a room full of kids? It should be able to, you don't need to sign in and sign out, and your profile doesn't matter, and all this stuff just doesn't matter. I don't want a start menu. I don't want to save my options. So, like, Happy Action Theater just starts, and you're just in a room full of balloons, and you're just like, go. And you're just like, and then, you know, now you're in a room full of hot lava, go. And kids just look at the screen, and they see themselves, and that freaks them out, and they love it, and they just instantly get it, and your grandma understands it and can play with your little kid. So it's just, that was an amazing experience. So
grandma's not so good at getting out of the lava.
Who was not so good at getting out of lava?
Grandma.
Grandma, yeah. Once grandma gets in lava, she... But that, you know, that was... And that was so... Not to jump ahead, but that's what I learned from Happy Action Theater was, you know, there's stuff you think, there's a way you think your game is going to be played, and then kids will do something completely different with it. So I assumed we'll put lava in and it will wrap around your couch and all this stuff, and kids will play hot lava like I played when I was a kid, which is you have to get around the room without touching the floor. So they'll get on the couch and they'll jump to the ottoman. That's the designed use of that activity. Kids jumped in the lava and laid down so that they couldn't see themselves on the screen, and they would just giggle. They're like, this is the funniest thing ever.
I'm
hiding under the lava. You can't see me. This is so fun. And they're like, okay, we got to do something special. So we made it so that if you do lay down and hide under the lava, when you stand up, your hands are on fire, and you can throw fireballs, and you can burn your dad and turn him into a Pompeii statue. And so we added that. So
that's all a kid ever wants, really.
Yes. And so what I'm saying basically is that children are the future, and teach them well and let them lead the way.
That's beautiful.
Thanks.
I don't want you to, you know, give away anything here, but do you think the Kinect 2.0 stuff could do an even better job of accommodating, like, a room full of kids.
It could. You would think we'd be working on that, but we're not. They have our number.
No news story today.
Microsoft, you got my number. If you want to do that, give me a call. I mean, I would love, because that was a, you know, we're making that game. We just wanted the video to look better. You wanted to have the edges of the, you know, we did a lot of amazing things. The programmers figured out this great ways to correct a lot of stuff and make it look good. But the new camera is super, the new, you know, high HD camera. I would love to do stuff with that. But
perhaps one day.
But the thing, yeah, yeah. But unfortunately, no one bought that part of the game that we made.
Like you said, it's not fair. It is just not fair. And I guess we'll zoom ahead a bit to get to Broken Age, which your most recent game.
I'm learning stuff on that all the time.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of lessons have you learned across, you know, Kickstarter and actually having...
If you're going to slip your schedule, just don't tell anyone.
Just keep it on the DL.
Yeah. No, we learned a lot because we're in just brand new territory with having backers and having transparency. So it's not just the Kickstarter thing, but having backers watch everything, watch you designing your game and cutting things and moving things around. And actually the backers, since they know a lot about the game, are pretty supportive of most of the things we're doing because they're partaking in the discussion and they're part of the decision making or at least they hear about it, what we're thinking as we're making decisions. And so it's a lot of it is just understanding the difference between the backers and the non-backers, because we think everyone is up to date on this project, and then when we announce the schedule's changed, and people who haven't heard about the game since we kicked off the Kickstarter are like, oh yeah, and like, and they feel about it much differently than someone who's been watching the doc the whole time. So that difference between people on the inside and people on the outside is something we learned a lot about. And also, 90,000 people are hard to embargo.
I can imagine.
Can't do that. And that's it. That's all we learned. Those two things.
Now, is it weird? Is it weird having sort of a set time limit like Kickstarter has for crowdfunding? Because it seems like I think Star Citizen had a Kickstarter, and then they just kept.
Yeah, we do that too. I mean, we don't abide. Yeah, so we don't abide by the 30 days is really important because people are excited and paying attention during that period, and it really does drive most of your money. But for us, you know, we did leave it open with PayPal afterwards, and people could back the project with bitcoins or whatever. And for up until the game shipped, we were still taking backers and we still made some money there, but the excitement of those 30 days, I think, just drives people to just talk about it and tweet about it. It's just people go nuts and they back it. So that's just learning people like an event to get behind.
What was the highest backing amount that you can remember?
Some of our super backers, I would say I think the level of that was 50,000, wasn't that correct? The super backers? At 50,000, you got to, should I say? Yeah, I think it was public information that for 50,000, you got to be a character in the game.
Oh. Almost a small price to pay, really.
Yeah, two people did that. Nobody backed, I think, $100,000. You got one of my copies of Day of the Tentacle Triangle Boxes, and no one did that. Thank God. I put that really high because I didn't want to give up my Triangle Boxes.
How many you got?
I have four. I have five. One's not in shrink wrap. The other are shrink wrapped.
Mint condition.
Yeah, some guy on the internet offered me $800 for one of them.
Whew, that,
so I'm saving them until my daughter's going to college.
And then you just cash out. Yeah. And when it comes to Kickstarter, like, again, I don't want you to be in any bad news headlines or anything, but if someone said, will you kickstart Psychonauts 2 and just see how much money you could get, would you do that?
Well, I mean, we thought about this a lot, obviously, because people have suggested this daily on Twitter, and that's where I get all my best ideas is Twitter. And so I, you know, we had such a success with that, with Broken Age and Massive Chalice, that it would be a great way to do Psychonauts 2. You know, as far as it was a great way to do any project because you get this love and money without strings attached. And it's hard to prove that we could make. You know, I feel like our actual full-blown Psychonauts 2 should be a certain size. It would mean a certain budget, and it's hard to take that leap you know, when we did our first Kickstarter, we were scared about getting $400,000. So that was a scary leap for us. We're like, oh, God, it's going to be so embarrassing if we don't make this. But, you know, we'll take that risk. And so now if we need something like $15 million, do we say that? Because, like, that's a big goal to hit on Kickstarter, but you don't want to end up with – like, if we only had $6 million, we could make a game. You know what I mean? It wouldn't be the same size as Psychonauts 1, and would that be the right thing to do? Mm-hmm. You know, if we had someone who had some money and expressed some interest in that, I – you know, and if they could match the funds for that, that could work out. But I feel like we'd want to really – we're pretty busy with Broken Age, so we haven't put our cracked all our skulls together to figure this out. But I think if you could figure out a way to actually get the money you need to make that game right, I think Kickstarter would be a... But as soon as you say that, people are like, well, why don't you Kickstart Brutal Legend 2? Or mm-hmm. why don't you Kickstart this?
Slippery slope.
I think we have to choose which game we work on next really, really carefully, because we often just have a whole bunch of new ideas that we want to do too. And I think I would love to go back to Psychonauts 2. Because one of the reasons is, like, I sometimes think... What do I really play? What do I really like? What kind of games do I like? And I think of all the games I've made, the game that comes closest to a game I would like to play is Psychonauts, because I love stylized worlds that feel like Beyond Good and Evil. I really enjoyed that, like places where you go and you just feel like you're transported to this crazy world. And I love like platforming and as opposed to shooting. Like, I can figure it out. I'm not very good at shooting, and I like physicality, like as opposed to point and click adventure games, which are fun. But I love that physical feeling of becoming skilled with a
like
little
weight
bouncing,
to...
jumping. Yeah, the character that, oh, I can grab a ledge and I can swing. If I'm really great with my timing, I can double hop on that thing. Like, I enjoy that kind of gameplay with the story wrapped around it. So I think Psychonauts really represents a lot of that stuff.
Do you only go for 3D platforming or 2D as well?
Well, there's something really about 3D that makes you feel like you're in a real place, mm-hmm. I think. You know, like you're really, you know, deep in it, in the dimension, the third dimension. But, I mean, I feel like anything can be made well or badly. So I think all game genres are interesting. Like, I'd like to do, you know, a lot of different things. But and doing a point-and-click graphic adventure was, like, a really interesting experience of remembering what I liked about them and, like, and then trying to bring in anything I learned from these other games into it, you know, and... make it modern, and that's been a lot of fun too.
Right on. And do you think people, like aspiring devs, need to come to Kickstarter with something to show, like a build
like I did,
already
like
done?
I did, which is nothing. I had nothing. I mean, I think to have a successful Kickstarter in general, you just need to have a good story, which is an interesting person doing an interesting thing in an interesting way, you know, and maybe you're not a person anybody knows, but you're like, if you look at all the look at the non-video game categories on Kickstarters for some ideas about what stuff has worked on Kickstarter, because there's like, you know, you're a guy that used to work at this company and now you've taken some of the ideas and you're doing something new with it, or you're someone who used to make a certain type of game and can't anymore. That was our story, right? You know, that kind of caught people's imaginations. But sometimes it's just, I'm a guy who's made all this other art. Look at these statues I made. Oh, they're amazing. Now I'm going to do them in ice cream or whatever. Like, it's like, you know, anyway, people can put together, oh, I get it. Oh, I get it. This guy is interesting for this reason, and he's trying something in a new way that he couldn't do without my money. I get to be a part of making this thing happen, and I'm going to love seeing the result, and maybe I can get a copy of the result or a picture of it or just have my name on it or something. But I can make this art happen that wouldn't happen without me. You know, because a lot of game people obviously don't get to be going. It's their first game, so they can't go and come to Kickstarter being all famous. But there's a lot of games on there that just have a different thing behind them. Like, sometimes I just thought the people who made the pitch video were just really charming and nice. Like, sometimes I'm just like, I want to back that project. And then with the I keep forgetting the name, but the one we were just talking about. Super like Riders, Hyper Light Drifter, right? That was purely based on they put forth a little section of their art, and it looks incredible. Like, I would love to play a game that looked like that, and that won me over that way. And they didn't show the people making it, you know. Mm-hmm. So one game got me with the personality of the people making it, and sometimes it just looks like amazing art, or sometimes it just seems like a crazy new idea that I hadn't really thought of. Like, that's really cool. Like Scale. I think when Scale went up there, I was like, oh, that I get that game. I totally get how that's going to be fun. I've never seen that before. oh my God, I want to play that game. Play back that game. So you don't have to be known to, you don't have to be famous to make a Kickstarter. You just have to have a great idea or be super charming or have
really good art
willing
skills.
To do nudity. I don't know. Something.
And are you an avid backer of projects, or do you sort of?
I do. I don't do it through the. Someone got really mad at us. They're like, "Double Fine, you don't back anything, but you want us to back you." I was like, "I don't do it through that account. I have my own account. I back through. I back so many that I don't even read the updates anymore. I just get the updates. I don't. Come on, just don't talk to me until you're done." Yeah. Which I feel bad because we send out all these updates. And we're like, "Hey, you love our updates, right?" Auto delete.
And is there any advantages or disadvantages inherent to breaking your game up into two parts?
They're definitely both. I mean, the advantage of splitting Broken Age in half was that people got to play it now. Mm-hmm. You don't have to wait till whenever we finish Act 2. And so we got a lot of feedback on the game that we can use in Act 2. We got a reaction from people. The team gets this little motivation of people liking the game and it getting good reviews, and that helps us finish Act 2. And the downside is if I thought of something while making Act 2, because Act 2 isn't totally finished the design. The design is roughly there, but as we implement, we always change the design. Mm-hmm. And if I get this idea of like, oh my God, I need this character to be foreshadowed in Act 1, it's going to be – I could still stick it in there because it's going to update on scene, but I feel weird about that because most people – you know, a lot of people played it already. So it's harder to go back and change Act 1. Like normally if you're making a game altogether, you can put these things back. So we really just had to work really hard to – design Act 2, know what we're doing. And there are a lot of things in Act 1 that are foreshadowing stuff in Act 2, mm-hmm. obviously, but we don't have the complete freedom to totally change it. You could say it's a negative that people have to wait for Act 2, but I feel like that's part of a good thing because like people could just rush through that game really fast and then it'd be all over. And I feel it's nice. At first, I didn't want to end in a cliffhanger because I got mad at the end of Empire Strikes Back. But I think when the first day I saw that final cutscene in and finally play, I was like, oh my God, we could totally just stop here. This is an awesome ending. I like this. So I think it works, and I think I'm happy it did because we're here. We're talking about the game. We don't have to wait as long, and we now have a lot more motivation to go through and finish the second act because we know people like the first one.
Right on. Well, thank you so much, Tim.
Thanks for having us.
Taking the time to talk with us. Yes. And everyone listening, go check out Broken Age. You can get it on Steam. Act 1 is out now, and
PC,
Act 2
Mac
is
and Linux.
On the way. Awesome. Thank you again.
Thanks.